This is Only a Game. I'm Anthony Brooks. Bill Littlefield is on vacation this week. The NBA regular season featured meltdowns by the New York Knicks, Portland Trail Blazers, Seattle Supersonics, and the Atlanta Hawks, among other teams. We can thankfully put those behind us because the NBA postseason begins today. Joining me on the line is Benjamin Hockman, who covers the NBA for the New Orleans Times-Picayune. And Benjamin, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me again.
It's good to have you. Now, the Detroit Pistons have the home court advantage throughout the playoffs. They're the almost unanimous choice of the so-called experts to repeat as Eastern Conference champions. Do you agree with that?
I'll consider myself a so-called expert and agree.
Tell me why.
Well, I just think the Pistons are playing their best basketball maybe in the past 4 years, and this is probably the weakest the Eastern Conference has been since the Pistons became the new hot team in that conference.
Now, would number two seed Miami be your choice if center Shaquille O'Neal and guard Dwayne Wade were completely healthy?
No. I'm still sticking with the Pistons, and frankly, I think the Nets could probably be the team to play the Pistons in the conference finals there. I think the Nets have the edge over even a healthy Heat team.
This is the first postseason for LeBron James of the Cleveland Cavaliers. Has the buzz over the so-called next Michael Jordan's first playoffs overshadowed the fact that Washington could be a sleeper?
Well, I think Washington will definitely give the Cavaliers a run for their money, but this is kind of what NBA folks have been looking forward to since James on the cover of Sports Illustrated as a high school junior it was. I mean, this is going to be the coronation of King James. He's going to win a playoff series, and suddenly he'll be pushing for conference finals. But reality will strike in. He's still 21, and he's still only one man, and I don't think they're going to get much further than the second round of the playoffs.
Okay, switching over to the Western Conference. The defending champion San Antonio Spurs are tired. Tim Duncan and Manu Ginobili have been hurt all year. Point guard Tony Parker has had to deal with the pressure of playing in the NBA and dating Eva Longoria.
It's tough. I've done it myself, writing about the NBA and dating her.
So to hear the Spurs talk about their playoff chances, you'd think the team was a number eight seed. Is that a good strategy for them?
The Spurs have that series. The Kings will give them a run for their money, as they say, and since they added Ron Artest, they're 26-14. They're a good squad. The Spurs will win that series, but I don't think they're going to win the conference.
Is there a chance the formerly hapless Los Angeles Clippers can win its first playoff series since 1976 when they were the Buffalo Braves, or have I just guaranteed a catastrophic knee injury for forward Elton Brand during tonight's warm-ups?
No, I think the Clippers are going to win that series. Obviously, the Nuggets are a good team, there's no question about it, and they've been in the playoffs the last few years. But I like this Clippers team. I like Sam Cassell as a leader. He makes his teammates better, and they're due.
Now, we should probably also talk about that other team from L.A., you know who I'm talking about, the Lakers.
That's right.
The Lakers. Many felt that Kobe Bryant was too selfish for the team to make the playoffs and could never work with Coach Phil Jackson. Bryant is now an MVP candidate, and many feel that this is Jackson's best coaching job ever, just as you predicted, right?
Well, I like this Lakers team. I don't know why. I just do. I was there the other night. They played the Hornets, and you watch Kobe, and you lose yourself. You feel like you're watching Jordan. But come on now, Benjamin. This is still a Lakers team. There's no Horace Grants or Scottie Pippen's around. I think they can win this series. It would be a pretty big upset. I just don't think the Lakers can make a run. But if they win the series, I'm pretty sure they could perhaps end up playing the Clippers.
Now, the Dallas Mavericks are the fourth seed in the West, but just about everyone considers them the team that can beat the Spurs and make it to the finals for the first time. Is this the best opportunity for the Mavericks to finally defeat their in-state rival?
I think so. I think everything's clicking for Dallas. Avery Johnson's a salty new coach. Dirk Nowitzki's a star, but he's got role players around him. They're finally playing some defense. Everyone made a big deal about no defense in the previous years. I like their post-play. Jason Terry's talented at the point. I think this is going to be a fun team to watch in the playoffs.
Which lower seed should we keep our eye on? In other words, which of them might pull off first-round upsets?
Well, actually, there's a couple that we mentioned. You look at the Clippers and you look at the Lakers. Those are two teams that can make a push. On the Eastern side, though, I think it's pretty much going to play out the way the seedings are, at least in the first round.
Now, I want to ask you finally about the New Orleans Hornets, who just missed the playoffs this year, but that doesn't make the team's story any less remarkable, given the circumstances after Hurricane Katrina. Has the team's surprise success lifted the spirits a bit in the Crescent City as it tries to rebuild?
Yeah, people are talking about the Hornets. It's really tough for these fans to follow a team that they can't go see with their own eyes, but we're covering the team as a newspaper, and I know the fans are talking about it when I'm here in town. I'm always getting questions thrown my way. There still is a buzz, but it'll be interesting to see if it lasts. Next year, the team's going to be in Oklahoma City for 35 games. They're coming back to New Orleans for 6. But I know the team wants to come back here. I know that the fans would love to have them. When they had the game here on March 8th, the first basketball game in New Orleans post-Katrina, it was a magical, important event.
The Hornets haven't always had a great relationship with their fan base. Will this help that when they come back and actually play in New Orleans? Do you think more folks are going to come out and be more excited about them?
That's a tricky question. On one hand, you've got the idea of if there's a team here that's representing New Orleans, that's something that the fans can come and be a part of and say, this is our city, we're coming back, and all that. But yeah, this wasn't the Sacramento Kings by any means, even before the storm. And obviously we lost a couple hundred thousand people in regards to population. So there's a lot of question marks hovering the future of the team here in New Orleans.
Benjamin Hockman covers the NBA for the New Orleans Times-Picayune. Thanks, Benjamin.
Thanks for having me.
The Stanley Cup playoffs got underway last night. Today, Colorado meets Dallas, New York visits New Jersey, and Philadelphia squares off against Buffalo. In the day's most intriguing matchup, Montreal, one of the NHL's original six, will face off against Carolina, one of the league's original 30. While the Canadiens have never had a problem convincing the locals that hockey is good, the Hurricanes have struggled getting the word out, ever since 1997, when they first arrived in Raleigh from Hartford. But the team has found a unique way to draw new fans via the classroom. Ron Schachter reports.
It's 7 p.m. on a Thursday, and in a conference room at the RBC Center, about 40 young and middle-aged men and women take their seats, unwrap their hero sandwiches, and leaf through the spiral-bound manuals on their desks. Save for a sprinkling of Carolina Hurricanes jerseys and the location at the Hurricanes home arena, this could be any training seminar. But the subject here is pro hockey, as taught by Hurricanes assistant GM Jason Karmenis.
With regard to the collective bargaining agreement, it's really the document that guides our day-to-day operations and the day-to-day operations of really any hockey department.
Welcome to Hurricane U, the graduate division, where the lecture and discussion range from the new collective bargaining agreement to the NHL entry draft and the intricacies of free agency. Tonight's program is part of a three-night package that costs $100. It includes an evening on the RBC ice with Hurricanes coaches, as well as a graduation ceremony and a Hurricanes game viewed from a luxury suite. Jason Worf is Carolina's manager of promotions and fan development.
A lot of teams are doing fantasy camps now where you go in and you skate with certain guys. We wanted to do a little bit more than just the on-ice fantasy camp type thing. We wanted to do the knowledge of the game, actually the knowledge of the business as well, because once you can obtain that, you really start to understand why teams make certain moves.
After Karmenis finishes, the students head to the locker room, where team trainer Pete Friesen takes over.
That's the suture room, and unfortunately we use that quite a bit, you know, to sew up people.
If a player comes off the ice during the game after getting popped in the face or something, do they come down here to get stitched up, or they get stitched up somewhere else?
No, usually right there, yeah.
The prerequisite for this course is Hockey 101, which the Hurricanes have offered since coming to Raleigh in 1999. Students learn the basics of the game, everything from the blue line to icing. Susan Gilbert, a freelance writer, says that introduction to hockey has kept her coming back as a fan and a student.
I grew up in North Carolina, so I wasn't raised on hockey, but the more I watched it, the more I liked it, and I wanted to learn about it because it's a lot funner to watch when you know what you're watching. So I asked for it for Christmas. So some women get jewelry. I got Hurricanes University, and I got graduate course again for Christmas this year.
And meteorologist Steve Harnett says he's sold on the combination of hockey classroom and fantasy camp.
they bring out the TV announcers, the radio announcers, people who really know about hockey to work with the students. And skating on the ice at the RBC Center is just to be on skates at center ice with a stick and a puck right in the face-off circle, and then look up and see the stands where, you know, where you usually see the game. It's just really a thrill.
Back in the classroom, there's still time tonight for a pop quiz.
With the injury to Eric Cole, the Hurricanes recalled Andrew Ladd. What year was Andrew Ladd drafted?
And then it's on to Friday night's graduation.
Wayne Bender, John Moser Jr., John Moser Sr.
Just before game time, the new graduates, in cap and gown, march onto the ice to Brahms' Academic Festival Overture, played on the arena organ. For the rest of the evening, fans like Wade Minter watch the game against the Florida Panthers with a newfound appreciation.
There are things you'll read about in the paper or see on the ice, but you don't really understand them until you're actually down there with the coaches telling you this is what we do and this is why we do it. And all you see in the paper is, you know, signed Doug Wade, but then you have to realize what they had to do on the salary cap to get him.
Hurricanes promotions director Jason Worf sees tonight's grads as tomorrow's season ticket holders. But even though recent Hurricane U courses have sold out, only a dozen Hurricanes home games did the same this year, despite the team's record-breaking season. Worf figures it may take 10 years to achieve the regular sellouts enjoyed by other elite NHL teams, like the Detroit Red Wings and the Ottawa Senators. But he says that the Hurricanes are well on their way.
A lot of the things we try to break down here is, the misperceptions of the area, and that it's either college basketball country or NASCAR country. We have a lot of people down here who could care less about either and who are diehard Hurricanes fans. We know the barriers we've got to break down, but they aren't as big as they seem to be made up sometimes. If you look at this year, our attendance is up higher than it's ever been since coming in, and following a lockout, that's a pretty big statement.
Hurricane U has inspired the Columbus Blue Jackets to start hockey classes of their own, but the Hurricanes may not be done. They're considering a doctoral program that would include on-ice practices and scrimmages with coaches. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter in Raleigh, North Carolina.
Bob Marley and the Hartford Whalers are not around. Bob Marley and the Hartford Whalers have left town.
It's 19 minutes. I'm Anthony Brooks. Ahead on Only a Game, running stride for stride with the Grim Reaper in the Grand Canyon. But first, here's a baseball trivia question. Which Hall of Fame outfielder inspired the phrase, "where triples go to die"? We're talking about a player who was known in his day as the best center fielder in the history of baseball. He was pretty good at the plate as well, compiling a career batting average of .345, hitting an astonishing 792 doubles, a record that still stands, and he's one of just six players to collect more than 3,500 hits. If you guessed Willie Mays, you're wrong. Joe DiMaggio, wrong again. Give up? The answer is Tris Speaker, a baseball superstar who's been largely forgotten. Now a new biography by author Timothy M. Gay, entitled Tris Speaker, The Rough and Tumble Life of a Baseball Legend, is resurrecting the memory of the great Tris Speaker. And Tim Gay joins us now from NPR's New York Bureau. And Tim, welcome.
Thanks, Anthony. It's great to be with you.
Well, it's good to be with you, and I really enjoyed the book. And I want to ask you why Tris Speaker fell into relative obscurity. But first, give us a little historical background about when and for whom Tris Speaker played.
Tris Speaker signed his first professional contract 100 years ago this spring, in May of 1906. He played for the Cleburne Club in the old North Texas League, Anthony. Hmm. Cleburne won the North Texas League pennant. The next year, he was transferred to Houston, led the league in hitting, was signed by the Red Sox in midseason, brought up for a very brief cup of coffee at the end of the 1907 season, then re-upped with the Red Sox, brought back up at the end of the 1908 season when the Red Sox were still playing in the old Huntington Avenue grounds in the south end of town, and stayed with the Red Sox through 1916. and then shamelessly sold to the Cleveland Indians in 1916, played with them for 10 years, and then toward the end of his career, banished, blackballed away from Cleveland, yeah. Played 1 year with the Washington Senators, and then finished up in a very unhappy final year in Philadelphia, playing with Ty Cobb and for Connie Mack for the old Philadelphia Athletics.
When he played with the Red Sox, he played with one of the greatest outfields ever in Boston. Harry Hooper in right field, Duffy Lewis in left field, Tris Speaker in center field. I think it was Grantland Rice who talked about that outfield saying something like they'd move into a different country if necessary to catch a ball.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. All three had exceptionally quick feet, Anthony, and all three had exceptionally strong arms. They were called the Golden Outfield, and Grantland Rice is just one of many writers back then who ran out of superlatives to describe just how brilliant they were in the field. Hooper, like Speaker, was ultimately elected to the Baseball Hall of Fame. Hooper had a right arm like Roberto Clemente. Speaker could cover ground like Willie Mays, and Duffy Lewis could move, as I say in the book, a little like Carl Yastrzemski in what became the left field of Fenway Park in 1912. Together, the Golden Outfield played 6 years. In those 6 years, they had an incredible winning percentage. They won two World Series championships and would have won a lot more had Red Sox management been not been so pigheaded in selling Speaker to Cleveland in 1916.
Now, he was credited, and you write this in your book, and now I'm sort of almost reading word for word here. Speaker was credited with revolutionizing outfield play, but that is less than true. The word revolution suggests followers, and few outfielders were capable of following Speaker's pattern. What did he do that revolutionized outfield play?
This was the dead ball era when center fielders could cheat and play in. He was virtually a fifth infielder. His signature defensive play, the thing that makes him so famous all these years later, is the unassisted double play.
The unassisted double play from center field.
From center field. At least six different times, perhaps as many as 9 or 10, Speaker would spear a fly ball or a line drive in shallow center field and then outrace the retreating runner to second base.
Wow.
The other play that is sort of forms his signature defensive brilliance is short hopping the line drive in center field and throwing the batter out before the batter could reach first base. Again, Babe Ruth on those old great old championship Red Sox teams said that it would happen so often there would be a ho-hum reaction in the dugout. Oh, well, Speaker just threw another guy out, you know, from first base the way an infielder would.
Like Ty Cobb, he had some pretty intolerant attitudes about blacks, about Catholics and others. He was a member of the Ku Klux Klan. But was he as tough and rough around the edges as Cobb, or did he mellow with age?
No, he definitely mellowed with age, and he was a lousy Klansman, I'm pleased to report. He claimed allegiance to the Klan, but I looked very hard and could find no hard evidence that he was, for lack of a better term, an active member of the Klan. He befriended Jews. He married an Irish Catholic girl, albeit very late in life, but nevertheless, she was the immigrant daughter of folks just off the boat. And he also tutored Larry Doby, the first African-American player in the American League. And they developed such a close bond, Anthony, that 50 years later, when Doby was inducted into the Hall of Fame, he acknowledged Speaker in his acceptance speech. Just a remarkable turnaround.
That is a nice turnaround, a nice story. Now, he came from Texas, and he was a real cowboy. And by that, I don't mean he just wore a hat and came up with cute phrases like cowboy up, but he was the real thing from Texas, right?
He sure was. Such a good real thing that Will Rogers had Speaker perform in Rogers' traveling rodeo show in the 19-teens and 20s. Speaker would be in the stands in full baseball regalia, and Rogers would be down on the floor and would call Speaker in from the stands, and the Speaker would not only perform some road tricks, but actually get on horses and perform real cowboy stuff. He was, his whole life, just a brilliant horseman and a great outdoorsman.
Now, the somewhat darker side of his career. You mentioned he was a contemporary of Ty Cobb. Like Cobb, Speaker liked to gamble, and that got him into some real trouble toward the end of his career. Can you tell the story that led to his fall from baseball grace?
In 1926, a former teammate of both Cobb and Speaker, Anthony, produced letters evidence, documentary evidence, and presented them to Ban Johnson, the president of the American League, which implicated all three men and Joe Wood in a fix that took place in 1919. The bottom line is that both Cobb and Speaker, who were titans of the game, player-manager in Detroit, player-manager in Cleveland, both resigned very quietly in the fall of 1926 and no explanation given. Then Judge Kennesaw Mountain Landis, the commissioner of baseball, who had been cut out of all the decision-making, got wind of what had happened. And he called a press conference and announced that there were cheating allegations against both men, which kicked up an incredible firestorm. At that point, Speaker and Cobb hired attorneys who advised them to compile an affidavit which would list chapter and verse of every sordid cheating episode they were familiar with. And, Anthony, they were familiar with plenty. Gambling had baseball by the throat back then. It's an unfortunate fact. At any rate, because this very explosive affidavit was put together, Cobb and Speaker basically won the game of chicken they were playing with Landis, and Landis had no choice but to back down. But there's little doubt that they were co-conspirators in that fix of the game that had taken place years before, and no doubt that they were involved in other sordid episodes. As I say in the book, the next to last game of the 1912 World Series was not on the level, and Speaker was clearly part of that cabal. Mm-hmm.
And so this probably also gets to the question of why we don't remember him very well, because although he wasn't banned from baseball, he never had the opportunity to manage, for instance, the great Yankee teams, for example, which might have made him remembered by more people.
I think they would have. He was such a brilliant manager. Bill James in the Historical Baseball Abstract gives Speaker credit for devising the platoon system, taking advantage of righty-lefty matchups, all the things that we take for granted in today's game. Speaker basically invented back in the 19-teens and 20s and took some very pedestrian Cleveland ball clubs and kept them competitive with the great dynastic Yankee teams of the 1920s. Sadly, after 1926, you're right, Anthony, he was blackballed. Landis would not allow him to take a managing job, nor would he allow Cobb, because they were both considered radioactive because they'd been in league with gamblers. Mm. So this brilliant guy basically stayed on the sidelines until Vec brought him back in the late 1940s as a part-time spring training instructor to work with Larry Doby and other outfielders, and he then became an advisor to the club.
Reading your book, I was struck by what a tough world it was. Ruthless owners who would exploit players as quickly as look at them, tough players who fought and played dirty, the whole gambling episode that you've been talking about. How do you think about that era of baseball compared to the way the game is played and managed today?
Well, the parallels between what is going on with the way baseball is handling the steroids scandal with how they handled the old gambling and corruption scandal of the 19-teens and 20s is really striking. Baseball is going to pretend they get to the bottom of the steroid scandal, and maybe they will, but I think much of our skepticism here is justified. The same happened with gambling. By throwing the eight men who had conspired to fix the 1919 series out, Landis pretended he was eradicating the game of cheating. He wasn't. He was just scraping the surface of what was going on, and I suspect the investigation of steroids will merely scrape the surface of what's happening here. For good and for ill, Anthony, baseball has always been a microcosm of American society.
Tim Gay is the author of Tris Speaker, The Rough and Tumble Life of a Baseball Legend, published by the University of Nebraska Press. He joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. And Tim, thanks for coming in today.
My pleasure, Anthony. Thank you.
I'm as dippy and as dappy as a daffodil in May, when its heroes of the diamond come upon the field to play. And it's hats off to old Mike Donlan, to Wagner, LaJoie, and Cobb. Don't forget Hal Chase and Foxy Mr. Chance, who are always on the job.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can also visit Only a Game's website at onlyagame.org.
Don't forget how Chase and Foxy, Mr. Chance, who are always on the job. Good old Cy Young, we root for, and Fielder Jones the same. And we hold first place in our Yankee heart for the stars of the national game.
Each year, hundreds of runners attempt to run the 21 miles from one rim of the Grand Canyon and back in the course of a day. There are a select few who prefer to run rim to rim to rim, and legend has it that there are a handful of stalwart striders who have run rim to rim to rim to rim. Unfortunately, many attempting to conquer the canyon have died of dehydration, cardiac arrest, heat stroke, or a combination of the three. But as Arizona Public Radio's Laurel Druly reports, those who survived the ordeal are returning in increasing numbers.
The Grand Canyon is essentially an inverted mountain in the middle of the desert. The views are majestic, but often deceiving. The other side looks much closer than it is.
People have no idea how strenuous running the canyon is.
Kathy Tibbetts is an experienced ultra runner who has traversed the canyon countless times.
Don't assume that because you can run a marathon, you're going to make it to the North Rim. It is really deceptively difficult.
That's exactly what someone thought not too long ago. In July of 2004, a marathoner from Massachusetts died of dehydration while attempting to run from the South Rim to the Colorado River and back. And her story is not a first. Today, Grand Canyon National Park officials have posted her incident report at all the trailheads as a warning. Kathy Tibbetts of Farmington, New Mexico says you have to know what you're doing. Tibbetts says she's seen several well-conditioned athletes hit their limit in the canyon.
Went over and ran with a guy. He's one of Brazil's top athletes. He's a personal trainer and does all the big races over there, and the altitude did him in. We got out just in the nick of time, starting to get dark, and he was swaying and stumbling and staggering.
David McKee, a runner with the Northern Arizona Trail Runners Association, takes running in the canyon seriously. The late fall and early spring are popular times to run to avoid the desert heat. But McKee says you still have to be prepared for all types of weather.
You always have to be prepared for climate change. It can be ice and snow at the top and can be very hot down at the bottom.
McKee says he checks the forecast in Phoenix, and it's usually the same temperature at the bottom of the canyon. Tom Myers, who worked as a physician at the Grand Canyon for almost a decade, says some runners aren't prepared for the drastic temperature changes.
One person that I remember well was a marathoner who was from the Midwest. He was extremely fit. He was in the prime of his life, and he did that very thing, the rim to rim to rim, in a day in the summer, and ended up in the clinic with heat exhaustion and IV bags flowing into his arms, and he was just astounded by what he encountered. He said, I had no idea.
Ken Phillips, who heads Grand Canyon National Park Search and Rescue, says he's also seen runners go too far.
It's people who think they know their limits, and they actually exceed those. And even experienced people get into trouble. Maybe you're not on top of your game that day, and you look the wrong way at the wrong time. And unfortunately, the consequences are pretty dire in the canyon. It's a long way to help. Sometimes help always can't get to you. Knowing that, people that go into the canyon need to really be constantly on top of their game, make sure that they're making that right judgment every single step.
Canyon officials say organized races aren't allowed, and they do not recommend or condone canyon running. But they have no official policy against running in the canyon. Richard Haig is a retired dentist who is training for a rim-to-rim run at Buffalo Park in Flagstaff. He says the challenge isn't just physical.
It's like a marathon. You know, your body runs out, and the only thing that keeps you going is your mind. You know, it's a mind-over-matter issue, and you just think, I can't go another step. And the coming out is the most difficult because it's the South Kaibab is 7 miles just almost vertical, you know. You've done, what, 30 6 miles prior to that, and it just really just kills you. It just kills you. And you get out, you hug each other, and there are times when you almost cry. You know, it really is, depending on the severity and how bad it was.
In celebration of his 60th birthday, Haig ran the rim to the Colorado River and back, and he's already planning his next rim-to-rim run. For Only a Game, I'm Laurel Drewley in Flagstaff.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, by the Dairy Farm families who own Cabot Creamery, 5 generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at cabotcheese.com, and Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting, available at the Implant Dentistry Center at bicon.com, bicon.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Anthony Brooks. Bill Littlefield is attending a support group for tragically optimistic Major League Soccer fans, and we wish him well. Ahead on Only a Game, paragliding in the Swiss Alps. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
When you get found in some alley with cleat marks on your face and a Tottenham Hotspur jersey over your body, you'll regret what that wisecrack you just made. I'm just telling you that right now.
Okay, I'll keep my eyes out. Now, since your last appearance on Only a Game, there have been 2 arrests in the Duke lacrosse story. A number of the team's underclassmen have reportedly asked the university for permission to transfer. Is this an indication that the team is more fractious than their attorneys led us to believe at the outset?
I think that's part of it. I think it's also an indication that the parents of these players are a little bit more fractious than we've been led to believe, particularly the ones who don't seem to be in any way involved with the ongoing fiasco. What's been revealed in this case beyond the facts of the evening in question is the fact that there was a pretty out-of-control Animal House atmosphere surrounding this program, and I get the feeling that there's more than a little bit of heat back home on the grounds of we're not paying $40,000 a year so you can behave like Bluto Bluktarski, pal. Let's see how you like Johns Hopkins.
Now, in the same story, and speaking of other colleges, Syracuse University says it won't allow Duke lacrosse players to come to its schools. Given that the Duke scandal involves 2 or maybe 3 players and there's still a presumption of innocence, is Syracuse justified in telling all these guys to stay away?
Syracuse is within its rights to do this, but I'm not entirely sure it's justified. A lot of these are kids that Syracuse recruited in the first place. It's a very small universe of people who play college lacrosse at this level. There's a little bit of posturing going on here, too, and a little bit of PR, and that's really sort of too bad.
Meanwhile, bookstores on the Duke campus continue to offer lacrosse merchandise, which one major sporting goods chain has pulled from its shelves at 5 Durham area stores. Should the decision to offer or not to offer Duke lacrosse gear be construed as tacit approval or disapproval of the men's lacrosse team?
I think it should be an indication of tacit approval or at least tacit support of the lacrosse team side of this story, and I think it's been a festival of disingenuous commentary all over the place, saying people running the bookstore saying we're not taking advantage of this situation, and blah and blah and blah and blah some more. Of course you're taking advantage of this situation. This is one of those occasions where I don't understand how people in sales sleep at night.
Okay, let's move from the Duke scandal to Barry Bonds, of course, who's in even more trouble this week, Charlie. What's the issue this time?
He got fined for wearing wristbands that violated baseball's apparel rules because the size of the wristbands and the logo that's on the wristbands. $5,000 he got fined. $2,500 a wrist, apparently.
Wow.
This is one of these awful rules imported from the National Football League, unfortunately.
San Francisco Giants trainer Stan Conte has been subpoenaed to testify before a federal grand jury investigating whether Bonds lied in his Balco grand jury testimony. Do you think Stan Conte will shed any new light on the steroid scandal?
It's hard to know since this whole case is based around what did Barry Bonds know about what he was doing and when did he know it. This is the we're running for re-election grand jury prompted by Congress and everything else. I don't think they're ever going to get a perjury conviction on this, but it will string the legal problem out for another 6 or 8 months.
Okay, now on Tuesday, Arizona Diamondbacks minor league pitcher Angel Rocha was suspended for 100 games after he tested positive for steroids for the second time. I was interested to learn that there'd been 81 minor league players suspended last season for positive drug tests. Now, if Major League Baseball's goal is to deter the use of these drugs, why were Major League Baseball officials so quiet about those suspensions?
Because they don't want any more publicity on this particular topic. Number two, they don't want to know how thoroughgoing this problem is at every level of professional baseball. And third, It's all well and good to suspend minor leaguers who are not covered by the collective bargaining agreement in the major leagues. These are the heads you can put on the shelf because they have no recourse.
And on a happier subject, a couple of weeks ago, Only a Game profiled 47-year-old Mets infielder Julio Franco, who on Thursday became the oldest major league player to hit a home run. I want to know what he's eating these days because I want some. What do you think?
Well, there's no question that appearing on Only a Game has rejuvenated more than a few old folks.
This is not unprecedented.
This is the reverse of the Sports Illustrated jinx. You appear on our show and your career develops a third and fourth wind.
The NBA playoffs begin today. Which matchups do you find the most intriguing?
Well, I think that Detroit and Milwaukee, believe it or not, is an interesting matchup because Milwaukee won the season series against Detroit. Detroit did not want to play Milwaukee in the first round. In fact, it can be argued that they conspired dubiously down the stretch not to play Milwaukee in the first round. They got him anyway, and I think the other thing most interesting is this will be LeBron James' first appearance in the playoffs as number 4 Cleveland and number 5 Washington in the East play.
After posting its worst regular season in team history and enduring an entire season of squabbling and second-guessing, the New York Knicks will apparently be rejoined next year by their ailing head coach, Larry Brown. Why?
Because nobody else wants the job, I have a feeling. I mean, this is one of the great you made your bed, now lie in it moments of all time. Larry Brown has spent an awful lot of time telling us how smart he is. He spent an awful lot of time proving how smart he is. Now he's got the deepest hole he's ever had to dig himself out of.
The NHL postseason began last night without the Pittsburgh Penguins and Washington Capitals. Do you lament the absence of rookie standouts Sidney Crosby and Alexander Ovechkin from the Stanley Cup playoffs?
Is this the NHL or what? They've got the two most marketable players they've had in years, and neither one of them is in the playoffs. Yes, I do very much, number one, because I did not see Sidney Crosby play this year, but I did see Alex Ovechkin play, and Alex Ovechkin is the most exciting young athlete in a team sport on this continent since LeBron James came into the NBA. So, yes, I do feel that bad. But we do have to mention, though, and they only barely qualified, but it is the Tampa Bay Lightning, which is embarking on the defense of the Stanley Cup.
Okay. Lance Armstrong will race again, only this time with a different set of wheels. Just what is Lance planning now?
He's going to run the New York City Marathon. And you have to give him credit because I think this is a good move for him because his feet have to be in great shape because they haven't touched pavement competitively
right.
in 20 years. Exactly.
That's great. Finally, Charlie, we have a winner in this year's Serbian Crawling Championship. That's right, crawling. 10-month-old Olivera Nedjela. You think she'll soon be choosing between Nike and Adidas diapers?
Either that or knee pads. I'm not exactly sure. But, I mean, those of us who attended college in the 1970s crawled much further than that, just getting home on Saturday night.
All right. Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and offers his sports expertise each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Anthony.
Just last month, I had the good fortune to take my family on a ski trip to Verbier in the Swiss Alps. The resort sits on a high, sun-drenched mountain plateau in the southern Alps, not far from the Italian border. It's a skier's paradise, but the soaring peaks and gentle southerly winds also make it ideal for paragliding, or parapente, as it's called in French. As thrilling as the skiing can be in this part of the world, to watch the paragliders jump off the mountains and into the sky takes your breath away. They use a collapsible wing that resembles a parachute. Here in Verbier, flyers take off on skis. You point them straight down the slope, and as you gain speed, the rushing wind inflates the wing.
Bye-bye. And then they just take off.
If you're lucky, you catch a warm updraft, a thermal, which lifts you high above the jagged peaks that tower above the ski slopes like giant cathedrals. You can circle up there for hours. It's Verbier's spectacular southwestern exposure and these reliable thermals that make it so attractive to veteran flyers like Fabien Maillard.
Now it's 7 years already, but yeah. Now is my first year's season in Verbier. Before I flew in Jura, in the north, it's very small hills. And after when you come here, it's a paradise.
It's a paradise. And tell me why. Why is it paradise here?
Why? Because if you want, you can take off in 12
and landing 7 nights.
So seven hours
you can fly.
Fabian says 3 years ago, a paraglider took off above Chamonix in the French Alps, caught a thermal and climbed up and up, and eventually landed on the top of Mont Blanc. That's Europe's highest peak at 4,800 meters, more than 15,000 feet. Fabian says it's not unusual for some paragliders to approach those altitudes.
Sometime in the summer, you can go 4,000 meters, I think.
That's more than 12,000 feet. Fabian is 26 years old. In the morning, he works as a ski instructor, and in the afternoon, he takes people flying. For tandem flights, he uses an extra big glider, which allows a passenger to hook onto a harness just in front of him and share the thrill of pure flight. So after coming to this part of the world for years and admiring these flyers, it was time for me to take the jump. But first, I needed a little information.
Good. And what do we have to be careful of? Is it dangerous?
Dangerous. Yes. You know, like a ski. If you don't learn ski and you go in really steep, it's very dangerous. Today, it's a little bit fun. You need a little bit practice today. And it's not for beginner.
Fabienne is referring to the so-called fern wind that can produce downdrafts and turbulence in these mountains, which can be fatal for light aircraft like paragliders. But Fabian assures me he expects no problems on this day.
Okay, this is for you.
So this is the
harness.
Around the leg.
Two on the front.
Soon I'm clipped in, standing in my skis, just in front of Fabian, who's attached to the huge canopy, which is laid out carefully behind us on the snow.
Okay, very easy for takeoff. You need with a ski paddle, and we go straight, and you stand up. After, when you fly, you can bend your knees and you can sit. And after, when you fly, you don't like something, you ask me.
Okay.
Or if you want more adrenaline, you ask me too.
Just point my skis downhill and then fly. And if I get bored, I just ask Fabian for some adrenaline. Sounds easy enough. The plan is to take off from about 7,200 feet, do some sightseeing, and then land in the valley. 4,500 feet below us.
Okay.
All right.
Very good. Tell me what to do. We're looking out now, facing in a beautiful alpine range of mountains, all covered in snow. Before us is a valley that is turning green from spring. There's no snow on the valley floor. And we're going to take off, according to Fabian, we're just going to ski straight down toward the pylons of a chairlift. And I hope we fly before we get to the chairlift, right?
Yes, I hope so. Depends on you.
Depends on me. Well, I think it depends on you, Fabio. I think I'm ready, so we're stepping forward. And now we're going.
One, two, three, go.
One, two, three, go. And we're going down, and the harness is pulling. And we are flying. Yes. Unbelievable! Oh, my God. So we're way up above the gondola. Fantastic.
We're suspended beneath the huge red and white canopy, connected by dozens of slender nylon lines, and it feels remarkably stable. The extraordinary view opens up wider and wider as Fabian finds a thermal and circles the glider up and up until we're looking down on the snow-covered slope from which we took off.
So below me I see skiers, and chairlifts, and telecabines, and the whole extraordinarily beautiful world of Verbier way, way below the chalets with snow on their roofs. And then below that, the green valley. Oh, it's fantastic. Oh, yeah, there's a hawk. Or an eagle. Is that an eagle? Yeah. Up here with the eagles. Just fantastic.
Fabian wants to know if I like adrenaline. This dramatic flight is about to become even more dramatic.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Wait.
À gauche.
À gauche. Oh, nice. Woo! Ha ha! Oh, nice!
Fabian pulls hard on the riser on the left side of the canopy, putting us into a tight turn to the left, then reverses direction, sending us into a tight turn to the right.
Et gauche encore après.
Ouais.
Nice!
Woo! Woo!
So we dropped quite a bit there. That's fantastic.
The maneuvers drop us down, and soon we're gliding over the village of Verbier toward the valley floor, 4,500 feet below.
So we've now come down over the top of Le Chable, which is a little village at the base of the valley. It's brown and green. The snow is gone. We're still, let's say, we're about 1,000 feet off the ground. And as Fabian said, we took off in the winter, and we're approaching Le Chable to land in the spring, where there's no snow. And still surrounded by an incredible view of soaring alpine peaks. Just beautiful. And now he's circling, making a tight turn to the right and then a tight turn to the left.
I can make some tricks now.
Fabian says he's going to make some tricks.
Okay.
Oh, now we're just going to corkscrew down. Whoa!
Again, Fabian puts us into a series of turns, but this time even tighter. And we drop quickly towards Le Chable. As we spin and plummet, I can feel the G-forces tugging while the ground spins up toward us. Then suddenly, we're floating quietly again above a grassy field.
So we're circling down now to the beginning of this threshold of this little landing field and rocking back and forth from the left to the right. And we're standing up and coming down on our skis and beautiful soft landing in the mud and grass. Fantastic. Nice job, Fabian.
Oh, c'est bon, hein?
C'est bon indeed. The flight took about a half hour and was probably the purest form of flying a human could experience. As for Fabian, it was just another afternoon at the office, and another customer is waiting for him back on top.
So I fly now, and after I fly with my mom's. My mother come here for a weekend, and I won't fly with my mother.
Nice. And what does she think about you, about this profession?
Yeah, my job is a little bit dangerous. She think before.
Yeah.
And after she flew with me, and after she won't again fly every time she come here. And she never stop.
Fabian Maillard flies with Centre Parapente Verbier in Verbier, Switzerland. To see photos of our flight and to find out more about paragliding, check out our website, onlyagame.org. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Gabrielle Scruggs. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287 toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to view my paragliding photo gallery, listen to stories past and present, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from a famous boxing promoter who was recently spotted making friends at a support group meeting for tragically optimistic MLS fans.
Hey, Bill, help you!
Who would have guessed that Bill and Don King could agree on anything? I'm Anthony Brooks. Bill Littlefield will be back next week. Thanks for listening.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. The W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, continuing support of individual creativity with the announcement of new MacArthur Fellows on September 20th. This is NPR, National Public.